28. I'm thinking of hitting Soleimani, President Trump said, pulling his golfing partner Senator Lindsey Graham aside on the afternoon of Monday, December 30, 2019. They were on the front nine of Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, Florida, 4.5 miles from Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate and club. Iranian General Qasem Soleimani was the head of the Revolutionary Guard's violent and covert special operations division known as the Quds Force. He was widely considered the most powerful man in Iran after Ayatollah Khamenei, and the driving force behind Iran's terrorist acts overseas. One of Soleimani's militias had just killed a U.S. contractor in a missile attack in Iraq. The next day, the situation would escalate into a siege of the American embassy in Baghdad. "Oh boy, that's a giant step," said Graham, unnerved. Killing Soleimani would be an unexpected play and a potentially dangerous one. Soleimani had menaced the United States for decades. Since 2007, he had been under surveillance by a specially formed U.S. intelligence cell created to target and stop the Quds Force from providing material and training to Iraqis fighting against U.S. forces. Over time, Soleimani became known as one of the most dangerous people in the Middle East, more in control of Iran's foreign policy than its Minister of Foreign Affairs. Soleimani had been in Trump's sights ever since retired general and former vice chief of staff of the Army Jack Keane told him while he was still president-elect that Soleimani had given Shia militias in Iraq an advanced IED developed by his engineers and scientists that could penetrate any known equipment on the battlefield, even a tank. Hundreds of American soldiers had been killed and wounded by the devices. Keane told Trump that President George W. Bush's national security team had asked Bush to authorize the destruction of two bases in Iran where Soleimani's forces were training foreign fighters. But Bush had refused, Keane said. Bush said he thought he would be impeached if he struck inside Iran. Graham, who had become a sort of first friend to the president, said that if Trump killed Soleimani, he would have to think about what other steps to take to deter Iran from further escalation. If they retaliate in some way, which they will, you've got to be willing to take out the oil refineries. Graham had reminded Trump for years that oil was the lifeblood of Iran's economy, the real soft spot. Threaten to take them out of the oil business, Graham urged. But, he cautioned, if you do, this will be almost total war. The stakes would go up, Graham said. You kill him, new game. You go from playing $10 blackjack to $10,000 a hand blackjack. He deserves it, Trump said. We have all these intercepts showing that Soleimani is planning attacks. Yeah, he's always been doing that, Graham replied. This is what he does. With the election coming, you've got to think about how you respond and how you expect Iran to respond. Threatening military action would have to mean a strike in Iran if Trump wanted to be credible. That risks major war. Graham had told Trump earlier in his presidency that Iran's theocratic rulers would eat grass before they would give up. But they could be influenced by economics in addition to ideology. Financial pressure and sanctions might cause the people to turn on their leaders. Iran was behind both the missile strikes that had killed an American and the militias that had stormed the embassy. We're not going to let them get away with this, Trump said. Mr. President, Graham said, this is over the top. How about hitting someone a level below Soleimani, which would be much easier for everyone to absorb? This was a role reversal for Graham. He was usually the hawk trying to convince a reluctant Trump to take military action. But a strike on Soleimani could mean the president was rushing the country into dangerous, uncharted territory. On the golf course, Trump tended to focus on the golf. He would drop out of the world, enjoying the endless tinkering with his swing. This week he was changing his grip on his clubs, strengthening it by turning his hands away from the target. He was pleased with the result. His drives landed 10 to 15 yards further, beyond 250 yards. Later, Mick Mulvaney, Trump's acting chief of staff, made an urgent request of Graham. Graham and Mulvaney had both served in South Carolina's congressional delegation and knew each other well. "You've got to find a way to stop this talk of hitting Soleimani," Mulvaney almost begged. "Perhaps he'll listen to you." 4 days later, Trump ordered the drone strike which killed Soleimani. Several hours after Trump and Graham's golf game, I was sitting in the reception area of Mar-a-Lago waiting to interview Trump, our third interview that month. I had no clue about a potential strike on Soleimani. I wanted to review with him Mueller's Russia investigation and Trump's impeachment by the Democratic House of Representatives just 12 days earlier. The news, the daily story, was impeachment. Or so it seemed, as I watched Mar-a-Lago club members stream in for dinner at what a Secret Service agent called the regular evening soiree. The club, originally built as a private home in 1927, was opulent and luxurious in an old-world way, like a gilded, candle-lit version of the Wizard of Oz's castle. A 16-inch plaque stood prominently on the receptionist's table. It read, "Donald J. Trump, the Mar-a-Lago Club, the only six-star private club in the world." Suddenly, Trump, in suit and tie, appeared with billionaire Nelson Peltz in tow. Peltz is the 77-year-old founding partner of Trian Fund Management, an investing firm whose portfolio includes holdings in Wendy's and other prominent brands. Prompted by Trump, Peltz said, "Oh, he's doing great things for the economy. It's all him." Peltz has a $123 million estate near Mar-a-Lago and saw his net worth increase from $1.4 billion in 2016 to $1.6 billion in 2019, a paper gain of $200 million. He kept pointing at Trump, repeating, "It's all him. It's all him. He did it." At one point, Trump pointed to the gold leaf on the 20-foot-high ceiling. "Look at that," he said. "See that? See that?" Trump then escorted me back to a private conference room. We sat next to each other at a large table. Hogan Gidley, his deputy press secretary, sat more than 6 feet away on the other side of the table, recording the interview on his mobile phone. We addressed impeachment. Trump told me he considered himself a student of history, adding, "I like learning from the past. Much better than learning from yourself and mistakes." Despite being impeached, Trump looked well-rested and relaxed. This contrasted with other recent presidents who'd been in trouble, Trump said. Nixon was in a corner with his thumb in his mouth. Bill Clinton took it very, very hard. I don't. Early in the interview, I mentioned Nixon's famous quote to David Frost in 1977 after he had resigned the presidency. Of his opponents, Nixon had said, "I gave them a sword, and they stuck it in, and they twisted it with relish, and I guess if I'd been in their position, I'd have done the same thing." In the rough transcript of the July 25th call with the Ukrainian president that the White House had released, Trump says, "There's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that, so whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me." I asked Trump whether, looking back, he felt he gave them a sword by releasing the transcript of the call with President Zelensky. "It's a perfect phone call," Trump said, repeating his public line of defense. "No, I don't. I didn't give them a sword." Trump continued, "They never in a million years thought I was going to release the call, number one. Number two, they never in a million years thought that we had it transcribed." Trump insisted he should be given great credit for having the transcript of the call released. "It's the transcript that's the sword for them," I said. "Let's assume I didn't have a transcription," Trump said. "Then I would have lived with a false report by a whistleblower saying that it was a terrible call." But the transcript proved that the whistleblower, despite not personally witnessing the call, had given an accurate summary in his report. Can I ask you this, President Trump? As a matter of policy, would you want the President of the United States to be talking to foreign leaders about investigating anyone? That's just bad policy, isn't it? Let me explain, Trump insisted. Biden was corrupt. You understand what I'm... As a matter of policy, do you want the President of the United States? I started to ask, but the President cut me off. I think it's fine, but there's no... Well, let me tell you. You do? When we're giving vast amounts of money to a country, I think you have to say if they're corrupt. Why is it that there's such corruption when we're giving it? And you know, there's another thing that I also talk about. And I talk about why isn't Germany, France, the European nations who are much more affected by Ukraine than us, paying more, he asked. Because Ukraine is like a massive wall. Think of it as a wall between Russia and Europe, okay? Understand, I said, but didn't want him to change the subject. Will you allow me to persist with, I think this is the important core question in this? There wasn't a thing, excuse me, Bob, there wasn't a thing wrong with that call. I did persist. Do you want the policy of the United States to be that the President of the United States can talk to foreign leaders and say, investigate? I want you to talk to the Attorney General about investigating somebody who's a political opponent? No, no, no. I want them to investigate corruption. What he did was corrupt. I want them to investigate corruption. And I didn't say, call my campaign manager. I said, the Attorney General of the United States. I understand the defense. I'm asking the policy question, I said. And you have to say one thing. No, I want corruption investigated. And how can we investigate corruption in a foreign country? How can we do that? We can't do that. We can't do it because we're not, you know, we don't have access. We're giving billions of dollars away to a foreign country. Yes, we should have the right to investigate corruption. I believe that strongly. I understand the points you're making. I'm asking the policy question. Is this a good policy for the President of the United States to be talking to foreign leaders about investigating anyone? Corruption. Yes, corruption. Well, but naming a political opponent. If the political opponent is corrupt, they can let us know. Look, his son, do you think that's the president's job? His son, Trump tried to go on, is that the president's job? I'm sorry to persist on this, but the president's job is to investigate corruption. If there was corruption, we're giving billions of dollars to a country, that country should let us know if there's corruption. You don't see the other side on this at all. I don't see it at all. No. Zero? No. If there was no corruption, but there was corruption. And when you look at that tape of Joe Biden, quid pro Joe, they call him, quid pro Joe, he said, enunciating each word carefully. When you look at that tape, Bob, that's the ultimate quid pro quo, okay? It's the ultimate. Trump was referring to Biden's January 23, 2018 appearance at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he talked about helping force Ukrainian Prosecutor General Viktor Shokin from office. Shokin's ouster had been sought by the United States and other Western countries for failing to pursue corruption cases, including an investigation into Burisma, the Ukrainian gas company. The president continued, I'm only saying this. Look, that conversation I had with Zelensky was perfect, but here's what happened. You had an informer who now disappeared. You had a second whistleblower who now disappeared. You had the first whistleblower who reported the call. He reported it totally different than there were 8 quid pro quos. Trump's facts were muddled. The whistleblowers remained masked under federal law. Several times in late 2019, the president said without basis that he had been accused of 8 quid pro quos, an exaggerated misstatement of the allegations against him. Trump then tried to shift the subject to Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff. I'm just asking the policy question, I said. Would you want the next president of the United States to be talking to foreign leaders about investigating political opponents? I would want the next president of the United States to investigate corruption. And in fact, we have a treaty signed with Ukraine because it is a very corrupt country in the past. Hopefully, the new president will do something about it, but we have a treaty that we actually have to do it. The Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty between the United States and Ukraine allows the Justice Department to investigate corruption in Ukraine, but doesn't obligate it. You see why I'm asking these questions? Look, what happened here is very interesting. Indeed it is, I said. They made up a phony conversation, Trump said, and it sounded terrible. Trump was referring to a dramatized summary of the call that Adam Schiff had given in a House Intelligence Committee hearing on the whistleblower report on September 26th. Schiff led into his heavily paraphrased account by saying, "It reads like a classic organized crime shakedown. Shorn of its rambling character and in not so many words, this is the essence of what the president communicates." Schiff went on to parody the call in the style of a mafia boss, wrapping up by saying, "It would be funny if it wasn't such a graphic betrayal of the president's oath of office." It was clear Schiff was dramatizing, but he had given Trump a big opening to criticize him. "When you released that transcript," I said, "you gave them a sword, President Trump." "No, the opposite." "Yes, you did. Well, I know you say you..." "Look, let me ask you a question," Trump said. "Sure, of course." "You ready? If I didn't have that transcript, I would have a very big problem right now." "No, sir, you would not." "Excuse me, I had a whistleblower." "There's a kind of clarity in a transcript," I said. "What's more, it contained the truth, released and validated by Trump." "I know this is going back to the Nixon tapes. As soon as you have a transcript, even though it's not entirely perfect verbatim, as soon as you have that, that's what everyone focuses on." "Here's my problem," Trump said later, summarizing. "The whistleblower report was a fraud." I had not yet read the public whistleblower report, but I knew the whistleblower had written that he was not a witness to most of the events, including the phone call. I also knew the report had largely been proven accurate. "If I didn't have a transcript," Trump said, "I would have had a big problem." "But it just would have been a whistleblower report," I said. "It has a very fuzzy status because it's just a whistleblower report." "I think you're wrong," Trump said. "It doesn't have any standing," I said. Unlike the transcript of the call he released, the report had not been hard evidence. "It's not proof." Trump went on to attack the report and the whistleblower's lawyer as a real scumbag. "Okay," I said. "You're willing to have this conversation, and you know me well enough. I really want to understand in a comprehensive way." I added, referring to the whistleblower report, "It's not evidence." But the transcript was evidence. It was proof of what had been said. Trump looked across the table to Deputy Press Secretary Gidley for backup. "Mr. President," Gidley said, "all I was getting was questions about this report. All I was getting, for days." "And by the way," Trump said, "I got approval from Ukraine before I released it, because I was very..." I said, "Geez, it's a terrible thing to do. A terrible thing to do." "So we called Ukraine. We said, 'Do you mind if we release this conversation?' And we got approval. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to release it." Our conversation had gone from interview to confrontation. He did not seem to understand or accept my central point. The President of the United States had no business asking for a criminal investigation of his political opponent. It was clear we were not going to agree, so I decided to move on. "I'm going to tell you something from my experience," I said. "Go ahead," Trump said. "Nobody more experienced." "Well," I continued, "you're willing to have this. As you know, in the Nixon case, I always said afterwards, as soon as the Watergate burglars were caught, if Richard Nixon had gone on television and said, you know, I'm the man at the top. I'm indirectly responsible for this. I'm sorry. I apologize. It would have gone away. I would never have done it here, Trump said. Yeah, Nixon should have done that. But I shouldn't have done because I did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. Have you ever found that you did nothing wrong, but apology is the path to ending the issue? I asked. I wouldn't apologize if I did nothing, Trump said. Can't do it. If I did something wrong, I could apologize. I said, I'm telling you, from too many decades of experience in cases like this, if you apologized, it would go away. I think if I apologized, Trump explained, it would be a disaster, because that would be admitting I did something wrong, and I didn't. The House Democrats who voted for impeachment centered their claims on the transcript of the phone call. You clearly wanted the Bidens investigated, I said, trying again. No, no, Trump said. I want corruption investigated. He repeated that he wanted to know why Germany and France were not putting up money for Ukraine. Why is it always the foolish United States? I know it wouldn't fit with your persona to apologize, I said. I would totally apologize if I did something wrong. I shifted ground. Who's the person you trust most in the world? Trump paused for several seconds. Then he chuckled and said, That's an interesting question. I don't know. I don't want to get into it because I have so many people. I have great family. I trust my family members. Okay, I said. Ask them if you should apologize. Bob, I think you have to look at the whistleblower report. I will, I promised. I indicated I realized he was allowing me to push him. I appreciate your indulgence. I am telling you my experience and my conviction, my repertorial belief. You gave them a sword when you released that transcript. Trying to get the Bidens investigated was improper, or as many Republicans would later say, inappropriate. I so disagree with you, he said, laughing. If I didn't have a transcription, they would have made up a story that was so phony, and I would have had no defense. I met Ivanka coming in, I said, referring to his daughter. Take her for a walk around this lovely place. I'll ask her, Trump said. And say, would an apology, carefully phrased, end this, or put it in a context? It would be a disaster, Trump said, in my opinion. Again, from across the table, Gidley jumped in. Disaster. You're right. You're 100% correct. The media would not give him. No way they would destroy him for that. I have this reputation of not being willing to apologize, Trump said. It's wrong. I will apologize if I'm wrong. When's the last time you apologized? Oh, I don't know, but I think over a period, I would apologize. Here's the thing. I'm never wrong, okay? No, if I'm wrong, I believe in apologizing. This was a totally appropriate conversation. It was perfect. And again, if I did something wrong, I would apologize, okay? Trump's best-known recent apology followed the release of the Access Hollywood tape in October 2016. Late in the interview, I asked again if Trump would take that walk with Ivanka. I will, but I disagree with you so much, Trump said. It wouldn't matter what she said. I pressed one last time. What would he do if Ivanka thought he should apologize? It wouldn't matter what she said, he repeated. Dan Scavino, Trump's social media director, had walked in. Trump pulled him into the debate. He thinks I should apologize, Trump said. I think if I apologized, it would be a disaster. I don't know. 100%, Scavino said. The media would kill Trump. Scavino, one of Trump's closest aides, had his laptop open at the table. Show him this thing, Trump said. You won't even believe this, Trump said. Watch this. Scavino played a 90-second clip, which was a spliced-together selection of stumbles, hesitations, pauses, and confusions from Mueller's testimony before Congress on July 24th. Interspersed were shots of members of the committee looking on in wonder, indifference, and surprise. It was funny in an unkind way. Mueller was visibly unsteady. Trump stood over my shoulder and watched. He laughed and chuckled, delighted, as if this was payback for the 2 years of Mueller. Next up on Scavino's laptop was a clip of Trump's February 2019 State of the Union speech for Congress, 11 months prior. Instead of his words, hyped-up elevator music played as the camera panned over extended shots of senators and members of Congress watching from their seats. One of the first shots was of Bernie Sanders, who looked bored. Trump had a different interpretation. "They hate me," the president said. "You're seeing hate." A shot of Elizabeth Warren was next. She was paying attention, but had a bland, unemotional look on her face. "Hate," Trump said. A shot of an expressionless Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Trump pointed at her. "Hate. See the hate," he said. The camera lingered a particularly long time on Kamala Harris, who had a straight, even polite look on her face as the dubbed-in music played in the background. "Hate," Trump said. "See the hate. See the hate."